20-6147 Muggenborg versus Nortek Air Solutions. Counsel for appellant, Mr. Hammonds, if you'd make your appearance and proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Mark Hammonds. I represent Keith Muggenborg, the appellant in this case. Mr. Muggenborg had been an employee of Nortek since 1978 until his termination in 2019 as part of a claimed reduction in force. This reduction in force affected 20 engineers, of which Mr. Muggenborg was one, and it resulted in the termination of two of the three oldest members of that group. He brought this claim for age discrimination, asserting that his selection was pretextual and inconsistent with the stated RIF criteria. Now, there are a number of permutations of the employer's explanation for why he was selected in the RIF and actually as to how the RIF was conducted. The initial statement given was that they were trying to get rid of the lowest performing members of the group and retaining the highest performing members of the group. The problem with that in terms of their explanation and why it changed throughout was that they had four new hires, two of whom were still not fully trained, all of whom were at least 20 years younger than Mr. Muggenborg, and much younger than that for the older person, who were retained and who were admittedly not performing at the level that Mr. Muggenborg was performing.
Well, I think the language was best performers, and why couldn't the employer link best performers to skill level? And it seems to me that that's exactly what they did. They said best performer at your level. So that would mean at SAE1s, the best performers at that level, or SAE3s, the best performers at Mr. Muggenborg's level. Why wasn't that something that the employer could do in fashioning their RIF?
Well, I think the employer could do that, but that isn't what they did, at least initially, in terms of their explanation.
Well, best performer, what I understood them to be doing, was linked towards the skill level. Why wasn't that what they said initially?
Well, that was actually what they said on July the 1st in their affidavit for summary judgment for the first time, where they said that they were making decisions within the categories of the engineer levels. But they only said that on July the 1st in an affidavit for summary judgment. They did not say it in their answers to interrogatories asking for the reasons for the RIF. They did not say it in their position statement to the EEOC during the administrative process. And they did not say that either during the RIF documents or in the explanation given to the RIF employees about how they were going about those selections.
Well, what about their response that they changed their, or to the extent that they changed their tune or refined their tune, they did it because you started whistling in a different way too. That in fact, you had initially compared yourself only against SA3s, and then you started comparing yourself against everybody else. Isn't that in fact what happened?
Well, Your Honor, when we received the information about how the selections were made, we did note that among the SA3s, they fired the two oldest members of that particular group. But we always pointed out that if you are keeping the lowest, if you're eliminating the lowest performers and keeping your best performers, how is that consistent with keeping people who have been rated as not performing successfully, even at the SE1 level, and who are admittedly still in training, not performing up to the standards of that initial group.
I guess my question, just to make sure I understand clearly the answer to this question, are you saying that initially you did not compare yourself only against SAE3s?
Well, I think in the complaint, Your Honor, that what we listed was that there were two SAE3s who were the oldest members of that group who were fired. But we don't know and did not get all of the criteria for this until the case progressed.
I'm not faulting you for that, but all I'm saying is if you in fact change your position, over time to once you had the information, then why should the employer be faulty for giving a different explanation that is responsive to your shift?
Because we're in two different levels of understanding. The employer knows why it acted at the moment that it acted. There's never any question to them. They're the decision makers. We don't know that. So obviously the plaintiff is going to refine their assertions as we learn the reasons that the employer presents for making a decision. The employer is not at that kind of a disadvantage. They start out knowing what they did. Therefore, this court's jurisprudence says that because they know, as a matter of fact, the 10th Circuit has said, because there are almost an infinite variety of explanations, the employer has to give the reasons at the outset.
Well, that boils down to pretext. And so in part that turns on whether there's something suspicious about this shift in explanation. Well, we've been talking about whether in fact the circumstances would suggest that it's suspicious, but our case law also speaks to the notion of if there has been what one would deem to be a shift, if the employer's new explanation, let's say, you know, in quotes, new explanation is supported by the record, then it becomes less likely to be perceived as suspicious. And so,
that's correct, Your Honor.
And so why isn't that the case here?
Well, because there's nothing in the record that supports that this was their reason until July the 1st, well over a year following the termination, well after they had answered interrogatories about it, well after they had stated their position to the EEOC. And the Hara Media case explains that a shift in explanation late in the proceedings is evidence of pretext.
Well, now, counsel, let me just ask you, you said something about the record, but didn't your client's sales performance and performance reviews deteriorate from 2017 to 2019, or at least go in a downward trend?
Well, Your Honor, he had 1 year in which he was not viewed as performing at a fully successful level. In 2018, he had been viewed as performing at a fully successful level. And of course, there are other persons who had the same ratings as that in the reduction in force. In terms of the sales issue, which is what Nortec seized on as their primary justification through this, Nortec actually changed the playing field on that. And we pointed that out in the motion. In 2018, if I recall correctly, he was evaluated as performing fully successfully. And part of the reason for that is they had him doing things that detracted from his opportunity for sales. So they said, you're doing what we want you to. You're performing satisfactorily in this area. When they decided to apply the RIF, they retroactively changed the playing field on it and the rules and said, well, he wasn't being satisfactory. That's not what the performance appraisal said.
Finish your thought. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, that is not what the performance appraisal for that period of time said. Performance appraisal said his work on sales was satisfactory. They retroactively applied a sales standard that they did not use that year and said he wasn't satisfactory on.
I thought in 2018 he was rated, I think it's a 2. Didn't he get a 2 in that year, which is a low rating?
No, Your Honor, I think 2018. I think it's 2019. Well, no, wait a second. The 2 years, excuse me, were 2018 and 2017. 2017 were the he had been rated as fully satisfactory in sales.
There are different categories of rating, but then there's an aggregate rating, and I'm talking about the aggregate rating.
And
the
aggregate rating in 2017 was fully satisfactory.
2018,
he was rated as needs improvement.
Okay, that's what I'm getting
at. That's the aggregate rating.
Okay, so you've got that aggregate rating of 2018 needs improvement. 2018 was also, let's talk about the allegation related to the complaint and how that factors in. He's the only employee who had a customer complaint, right?
Well, that's what they say, Your Honor.
Well, talk about it. What's your view?
With regard to that, Your Honor, he was ranked and rated his performance about his interactions with customers and coworkers, and ranked as satisfactory in those areas. There was no mention in the performance appraisals for those time periods that his performance was unsatisfactory based upon a customer complaint. That is, in other words, more clearly evidence of tailoring than it is of a legitimate reason. They went back and picked a factor which was not explicitly part of any of the RIF criteria and said, we're going to bring this out, even though it would be subsumed in a performance appraisal, and even though the performance appraisal raises no issue, and he wasn't disciplined for that matter, and say this is a reason for selecting him.
And clarify this for me, because maybe I misread it. I know that the performance appraisals did not specifically identify this incident. I know that. But I thought that the 2018 performance appraisal talked about concerns about his interaction with employees and counseling on how he, not employees, I'm sorry, customers, and counseling on how he should deal with them. Am I mistaken about that? I thought
on a different matter, Your Honor. They said that in terms of his timing and willingness to estimate a time for completion of a project, that he needed to be more flexible with regard to that.
And that relates to customers, right?
In relation to customers, that was not the customer complaint, Your Honor. The customer complaint was supposedly mistreatment or a failure to interact. And there was no issue of that being a substantial factor at any point in time until retroactively. Now, remembering that no employees are going to be perfect and don't have to be perfect to be protected from discrimination, any employer can go back and say, well, this employee's weak spot is this. Now, that's not part of our criteria. That's not something we've listed. That's not something we disciplined the employee on. But because we know it's out there, now we're going to engraft it, though it's not a RIF criteria, and make it one to justify our decision and apply it retroactively. That's the doctrine of tailoring and is evidence of pretext.
Well, yes, I get that. And in the Juarez case, we talked about that issue, but that issue, there were some stark examples of them tailoring the RIF criteria in Juarez to essentially exclude older people. In other words, they took out job tenure and they took out past performance reviews. What do we have anything stark like that here?
Well, yes, Your Honor. In the context of this, the original RIF criteria were job skills, job performance, job elimination, and duplication. On job skills, they essentially took that out. Now, I know that there was a claim that the job performance incorporated job skills, but the initial testimony of the HR representative for the defendant was that they didn't consider job skills.
Why is anything she says relevant? She's not a decision maker. Who cares what she says?
Well, she was the one who monitored and signed off on all of the terminations. She did not make the recommendations, but this is the person who oversaw the reduction in force process.
But isn't the decision maker the operative issue in these kinds of cases? I mean, if somebody else had a different view of what was relevant, what wasn't relevant, how does that factor into this? I mean,
if there's a difference between the viewpoint of people involved in the decision-making process has been recognized as one of the grounds for finding pretext.
Absolutely. But involved in the decision-making process, my point is that the HR person was not involved in the decision-making process. She wasn't a decision maker. Do you dispute that?
Now, I don't think she was a per se decision maker, but she did review and was the one who was approving the decisions, calculating the impact and determining whether or not the RIF criteria had been followed or not followed.
Let me just run something by you and get your reaction to it. on this argument of inconsistency, when I read Mr. Brady's affidavit, I believe, and he talks about being mindful of maintaining balance, and that's where in their workforce and having SEE1s do less complicated work, that sort of thing. One thing that occurred to me, and I'm sure you'll disabuse me of it, but one thing that occurred to me is, why doesn't that suggest that baked in from the very beginning, in terms of when they said job performance is what matters, best performers, baked into that was an understanding that that related to skills, I mean, skill level. And therefore, there's nothing inconsistent about saying later that we were mindful of having a balance in the workforce, because when they said best performance, they were always considering best performance at a certain level. And that seems to be entirely congruent with the notion of later saying that we were mindful of maintaining balance in our workplace. Tell me why I'm wrong.
Okay, there are two reasons for that, Trump. The first reason is that there's an inconsistency between what they said their goal was and the claim of a balanced workforce. They did not say at the beginning that they were looking at finding the best performers in a grade or level. They said they wanted to keep the best group of performers and eliminate the lowest performers. If you're doing a balanced workforce, which was the last permutation of their explanation, that's the opposite. That says we're going to get rid of some of our better performers in favor of some of the lesser performers, because our goal is not the best performing group. It is to have a group that has X number of SAE3s, X number of SAE2s, X number of SAE1s. Not the best group of performers, but a group matching up with that number. Now, the other part of it is, besides being inconsistent with their stated goal, is that they never said that. They never said our goal is we want to have X number of SAE3s. For instance, that's where the eliminations came from. They got rid of two of those. They simply didn't say that. If you're talking about a balanced workforce, then the selection and force process is we determine how many people we need as ones or twos or threes or fours. They made no such determination.
Well, I mean, Brady didn't say it was determinative. He just said that they were mindful of it. I mean, is that not a distinction with a difference?
I don't think it is a distinction with a difference when you compare it with the original criteria.
Okay.
If you're mindful of it, then supposedly they'd still have to follow the written criteria that was announced by the company. But he used that to deviate from it and say, we're going to keep people. Two of the SAE1s were admittedly not fully trained. Had more areas where they needed improvement than where they were considered satisfactory, even under that lower criteria.
Okay, Mr. Hammond, we'll allow you some time in rebuttal, but we need to. Right. Your time is up, and we need to move on.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please, Mr. Whatley.
Thank you. May it please the court. You know, the basic thrust of Plaintiff Muggenborg's argument, both in the district court and here on appeal, is that Nortek should have used seniority and grade or rank as the basis for its RIF selections and kept him instead of employees who had less experience but were better performers. And despite the fact of his low and progressively worsening sales number, his poor performance reviews, and his customer complaints. This is a glaring example of a plaintiff trying to substitute his judgment for the employer's business judgment, and it should not carry the day. It didn't carry the day below, and it shouldn't here.
Counsel, could I just ask as a starting point, we're at the pretext issue. They're trying to rebut your legitimate non-discriminatory reason for what happened here. But what is that reason? Why isn't the disclosure in the OWBPA the legitimate non-discriminatory reason? And it included the four criteria. And I think what the plaintiff, appellant, is trying to say here is that all of a sudden it became a moving target as we went through the litigation. So what should we be using to measure against the pretext arguments?
Certainly, Your Honor. All along, NorTec maintained that it was trying to keep the best group of performers, and they said that plaintiff's selection and his evaluation, his performance, is what caused him to be selected. It was driven by sales and customer complaints. That was consistent throughout. Now, as his complaint began to change throughout the case, and he started to say not just that he should have been compared differently to the other senior SAEs, which is what he talked about in his EEOC charge, what he talked about in his complaint. After his deposition, it became clear that he was saying, well, maybe you shouldn't have kept those younger people that didn't have as much experience as me. Well, certainly at that point, we were tasked with explaining how that fit into the analysis. And it fits perfectly into that analysis because they were still looking at performance and looking at those criteria. And it's not at all inconsistent what they did. It was an explanation. They elaborated on how the decision was made, but it was still driven by performance. And if you look at those factors, if I may, you know, the plaintiff in his brief talks about a quote from Sanchez several times talking about you have to look at the overall reality of the situation. And that's when you do that, you're driven to the conclusion that that the district court made the right decision.
Mr. Wiley, didn't Mr. Brady say at one point that Mr. Muggenborg was selected to create a quote unquote balanced workforce? How do you square that with poor job performance as the reason?
Certainly, Ryan. I don't believe that he said that he was selected to create a balanced workforce. I think what he testified to was the idea that that was something that was in consideration when they tried to look at those criteria you mentioned, which included skills, duplication, and overall performance. And so when evaluating the SAE1's performance, they had to look at what it was they were performing. Just like with the sales goals, where an SAE one had lower sales expectations than a two and a three had lower than a four, there were various things that were being performed, and that's how those people were being judged. That's typically across employment that an employee will be evaluated and judged on what it is they're supposed to be doing. That's how their performance is judged. And I think that's what he was trying to get out there. Not that they only wanted a certain number of SAE ones or a certain number of SAE threes, but that made sense to them in trying to look at it, that there were certain types of projects that a newer employee might make or a lower level employee might be involved with, and certain projects that seniority was needed. But if you look at what plaintiff is suggesting, you know, you could have been left with 9 level threes, 4 level fours, and then only 2 levels one and two. And so certainly that would be a situation that might leave certain duplication involved, might leave certain needs of the company unmet.
Is it clear, counsel, that he outperformed the one?
It is, Your Honor, in the sense that when you start to look at things over time, now certainly at the beginning, they didn't have sales requirements, but when you look at the sales numbers that the SAE ones had coming into 2019, which is when the RIF decision was made, 3 of those SAE ones had better sales numbers across the board than the plaintiff. One of them had better numbers in 2 categories than the plaintiff.
Is that for only 2019? That's only a half of a year. It wasn't a full year, was it?
That's correct, Your Honor. But that was a time period where those numbers were being kept for them. Prior to that, they were expected to show some ability to sell and to progress in that area, and they did. And then
did he outperform them in 2018?
I would say the answer is if you look purely at sales numbers.
What does the record show?
Sure.
Show that he outperformed them in 2018.
Well, Your Honor, I guess that if you're asking about sales numbers, then yes, his numbers were higher. Outperforming them across the board, I don't know that it does, because they were meeting, and the evaluations that they received were threes. His overall evaluation was two for performance. So in that sense, no, he did not outperform them.
Well, did he outperform them in 2017?
They were not there in 2017, Your Honor.
The SA, the
once. SAE once. Yes, Your Honor. But it, to touch on a couple of other points, the reliance that plaintiff has tried to place on testimony from the HR director is misplaced. It's very clear from the record and the findings of the district court that she was not a decision maker. Plaintiff admits that. Her role really was to provide documentation for the decision makers if they needed to request anything, and to take information after the selections were made and to look for any red flags. She asked them to give her a small subset of what they looked at so that she could compare performance metrics and ages, and to make sure that she didn't see, or that legal didn't see, some type of a red flag. She wasn't there to approve the decision or to oversee the process. She was simply there for that purpose. So when she talked about whether skills were looked at or not, there was some early on, there was some testimony in her deposition that she wasn't sure about it. But then later she said, I'm sure that they did. That's something that they looked at. The same thing with the 2019 numbers. There was some challenge in the opening brief, and then perhaps in the reply brief as well, that the 2019 numbers weren't something that would have been considered. But in fact, they were. I mean, the testimony that she gave later was that those are numbers that the decision makers would have seen routinely on a monthly basis. Email from Mr. Brady indicates that he was forwarding those very numbers to Mr. Roncart and copying Ms. Smith to show that, you know, here are some numbers that show what's happening here. And he remarks there, you know, numbers on the sales are not the only thing we're going to look at, but by this metric, you can see these SAE ones are outperforming Mr. Muggenbohr. So that's something that clearly was looked at and that the decision makers did take into consideration in that situation. As I was saying, the plaintiff.
Where did the customer complaint factor into the paperwork and the evaluation? It's my understanding that in the 2018 performance review, at least explicitly, it's not mentioned at all. And therefore, where does it come into play?
You're correct, Your Honor. It's not explicitly mentioned in the written performance evaluation that was done by, it wasn't done by Mr. Brady. It was done by another supervisor. But there is discussion in there about customers feeling like Mr. Muggenbohr told them no too often and didn't listen to their concerns or to the timing needs that they had. So clearly you can glean from those appraisals that customer satisfaction is important to performance. Where it comes in is that this customer complaint was escalated to Pierre Roncart, the vice president, who was also involved in the decision-making. And to the extent that he had to become involved and sort of set up an apology conference call with that customer. So he was very well aware of it. It happened in November of 2018. And as they were coming into 2019, it was fresh in his mind as they were tasked with this reduction in force, what had happened.
And to that point, just as a matter of law, there were specifications of what the criteria are that were operative in the RIF, one being job performance. Even if it were not expressly mentioned in either 2017, 2018 performance review, since Mr. Roncourt had that as his personal knowledge, was he permitted to say, look, we're sitting here looking at this job performance, and I'm saying that I know that we should weight against him, Mr. Muggenbohr, on the job performance because of the complaint that I had to mediate or address. Is that permissible? I mean, is there anything that would have prevented him from doing that?
There's nothing that would prevent that, Your Honor. Certainly, it's clear from the way that the reviews are set up, the importance of customer satisfaction. The Ron Carton and Brady were tasked with finding the best performers, and a clear element of performance is customer satisfaction and the existence or lack of customer complaints. No one challenges that this occurred. Now, plaintiff is dismissive of it and says that perhaps it was frivolous, but from the standpoint, there's no dispute whatsoever that this complaint came in and that there had to be this conference call with the vice president involved with it. And there's nothing that would prevent them from considering that as a part of performance. You can't put into your criteria and a definition of what you're looking for every conceivable thing that might fit into it. You know, they talk about performance, and then they talk in their criteria again about performance, and then an explanation of that would include things such as customer complaints, sales, and so forth. Clearly, this was important to them from the very outset, as it was mentioned expressly in the response to the EEOC charge as one of the driving factors.
As a if I may, because your time is getting a little short, as a, in concise fashion, what's your best argument for why Mr. Brady's comment about being mindful about a balanced workforce, why that is no more than an elaboration on the position that had been taken earlier?
Well, Your Honor, I think similar to what I said before, they had to look at performance, and that's going to be different for people in different grades in terms of what's expected of them and what their performance measure is going to be. Because of that, I think his thought was to look at it in a way that would give the company people that could perform at all different levels and different levels of responsibility and different tasks. I don't believe that he was suggesting that they were changing the basis of the RIF in any way. And certainly, I think the other important thing to keep in mind is that to the extent it is any type of deviation, it does not undermine the reasons that were given. In other words, the reasons that were given in terms of performance are fully supported by the customer complaints, the sales numbers, the performance reviews, and the balance to the workforce is also consistent with the element of duplication and job elimination.
But on the elaboration point, I take it then and see, this is what I hear you saying, that in some sense it was a more detailed explanation of performance. In other words, it just really is an elaboration of that performance criteria to be mindful of a balanced workforce, to have performance at the different skill levels.
Absolutely. That's exactly correct.
Is that fair?
Yes.
Okay.
In terms of, again, talking, he talks about a shift, but I think the case law is clear that if there are explanations, those are not considered to be a shift and not as a basis for pretext. Additionally, the court looks at whether there's a lack of evidence to support what's being said there. So it's not just that they look at, is there something that's additional added there or also talked about, but whether it goes against the evidence or goes against the overwhelming approach taken by the employer. Can I see my time?
Yes. Absent any other questions. Mr. Hammonds, we'll give you 1.5. Okay. So, I mean, a minute 30, and you don't need to take it all. Do with it what you will.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. For the 2019 sales, I'd like the court to remember that that's a 3-month snapshot that even they did not consider to be representative of overall performance in the sales area. It's too small a time period to gauge that. In terms of a change, the question is, at what point in time does that become a question of fact for the jury? I would suggest that when you make a change very late in the process, which alters how you analyze the decision, that's a jury question. That is supposed to be interpreted in the light most favorable to us as the non-moving party. So the facts that we presented are, at the beginning, they said all of these people in the different grades are compared against each other. There's specific testimony that we presented to the court to say that's how they applied the RIF process. That didn't really pan out because the RIF criteria that they adopted, which were inconsistent with the written RIF criteria, said that we're going to consider certain factors, some of which they simply didn't apply at all. Among those, are you're supposed to have 2 years of performance appraisals and 2 years of sales, and none of the young people could meet that criteria. They had to exempt them from that. They had to exempt them from the sales goals to use that as a justification to eliminate older employees who were performing higher, but had to perform higher even than that to retain their jobs. That's evidence of discrimination and a fact question for a jury.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hammonds. Thank you for your arguments, both counsel. Case is submitted.